Hello, this is Dr. Grande. Today I will analyze the case of Denise Amber Lee. First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Denise Amber Lee was born on August 6, 1986, and lived in Northport, Florida. This is 87 miles south of Tampa. Denise was raised by her father, Richard, and her mother, Susan. In 2004, she graduated from high school. On August 20, 2005, Denise married a man named Nathan Lee. The couple went on to have two sons, Noah and Adam. The family rented a 1,600-square-foot house on Latour Avenue. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On January 17, 2008, at about 3:30 p.m., Nathan Lee called 911 from his home in Northport, Florida. He indicated that he had arrived home from work and was unable to find his wife, Denise. He had checked every possible place she could be inside the house, and she was not there. The doors of the house had been locked when he arrived home. Denise's vehicle was in the driveway, and her keys, purse, and cell phone were inside the house. 2-year-old Noah and 6-month-old Adam were in a crib together in Adam's room, which was out of the ordinary. When the police arrived, they found no evidence of forced entry into the house and no sign of a struggle. They spoke to a neighbor named Jennifer, who told them that between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m., she noticed a green Camaro driving very slowly on Latour Avenue. The Camaro drove by 4 or 5 times, leading the neighbor to believe the driver was lost. When Jennifer walked outside to investigate, the vehicle pulled into Denise's driveway. She made eye contact with the driver, but returned to her house believing the driver had found the destination he was looking for. About 10 or 15 minutes later, Jennifer exited her house again and saw the Camaro drive away from Denise's house. She did not see Denise enter the Camaro. A few hours later, at 6:14 p.m., Denise Amber Lee called 911 from the phone of a 36-year-old man named Michael Lee King. Michael was an unemployed plumber who lived on Sardinia Avenue in Northport, 4 miles east of Denise's house. He owned a green 1994 Camaro. On the 911 call, Denise repeatedly said, "I'm sorry, I just want to see my family." It seemed clear from early in the call that Denise was in Michael's vehicle and being held against her will. She had taken his phone and called 911 without Michael knowing. Denise was speaking to Michael, but her messages were intended for the 911 operator, so the police could find her and rescue her. Michael could be heard in the background of the call. He was upset because he could not find his phone. Michael said, "I was going to let you go, and then you blanked around. Where's my phone?" Denise repeatedly stated, "Please let me go." A moment later, Denise said, "Please, my name is Denise. I'm married to a beautiful husband, and I just want to see my kids again." Michael asked, "What did you do with my cell phone?" Denise responded, "I don't know. Please, protect me. Please, I don't know where your phone is. I'm sorry." After this, Denise responded to questions asked by the operator. For example, she said, "I don't know," when the operator asked, "How long have you been gone from your house?" When the operator asked, "What's your last name?" Denise responded, "Lee." Toward the end of the call, Michael said, "Give me the phone." Denise said, "Are you going to let me out now?" Michael said, "As soon as I get the phone." Denise said, "Help me." At this point, the call terminated. The police immediately started looking for Michael Lee King. They searched his house and found evidence that he had sexually assaulted Denise there. At 6:23 p.m., a 17-year-old girl named Sabrina Muxlow called 911. She told the operator information that her father, Harold Muxlow, had relayed to her. Here is the story she provided. Michael Lee King, who was Harold's cousin, had stopped by Harold's house sometime between 5:30 p.m. and 6 p.m. that day. Michael asked Harold for a flashlight, a gas can, and a shovel, explaining that his lawnmower was stuck in his front yard. Harold provided the items to Michael and started walking back to his house when he heard a female voice coming from Michael's green Camaro. The voice yelled, "Call the cops." Harold walked down the driveway toward Michael and asked what he was doing. Michael said, "Nothing. Don't worry about it." Harold turned around and started to walk back toward his house, but became suspicious and once again walked toward the Camaro. He could see a person in the back seat of the Camaro. After Michael pulled away, Harold drove to Michael's residence to determine if there really was a lawnmower stuck in the yard. When he arrived, he noticed that there was no lawnmower, and Michael's Camaro was not there either. This is when Harold called his daughter Sabrina, and she called 911. Harold did not call himself because he did not want to be involved. Only later did he contact the police directly. At 6:30 p.m., a woman named Jane Kowalski called 911. She told the operator that she had been stopped at a traffic light on U.S. 41 when she heard a scream coming from a Camaro in traffic next to her. Jane believed the person screaming was a child, and she thought the Camaro was blue. Two details that were not correct. She made eye contact with the driver, who was later identified as Michael Lee King. Jane said that the driver pushed something down in the back seat. At this point, a hand rose up from the back seat and started banging loudly on the passenger side window. She tried to get the license plate, but the Camaro was now behind her and would not pass her. The driver was moving so slowly, he was interfering with traffic. Eventually, the Camaro moved to the left lane of US 41 and turned left onto Lido Blade Boulevard. Jane was unable to follow the vehicle. Based on where Jane was located, her 911 call was routed to Charlotte County instead of Sarasota County. Unfortunately, the 911 operator failed to enter Jane's call into the computer. Instead, the information from the call was written down and handed to dispatchers. This meant that the police looking for Denise were not notified about this sighting of the Camaro. At 9:10 p.m., Michael's green 1994 Camaro was spotted by the police driving on an on-ramp for Interstate 75 southbound in Sarasota. A traffic stop was initiated and Michael was placed under arrest. He was alone in the vehicle. Denise was not there. The police searched the vehicle and found a gas can, a shovel, strands of blonde hair, and a woman's ring. Later, the strands of hair were identified as belonging to Denise Amber Lee, as was the ring. On the driver's side window, there was a palm print belonging to Denise. Michael was wet from the waist down, and he had mud on the bottom of his shoes. The battery and SIM card from his phone had been removed. Michael claimed that he had been kidnapped along with Denise, so he was a victim too. Before he could offer more details, the police gave him his Miranda warning. Michael said, "I want an attorney." The police continued interviewing Michael anyway. They knew his statements would be suppressed, but this was an emergency. They needed to find Denise. Michael indicated that he picked someone up by the side of the road. This man kidnapped him. When asked to explain why he went to his cousin's house and borrowed the shovel and the other items, Michael claimed he did this at the direction of the kidnapper. On January 18, 2008, a woman involved in the search for Denise noticed a disturbed area of dirt near Plantation Boulevard in Northport. One day after this, on January 19, the police excavated the site and found Denise's body 3 feet in the ground. She had died from a single gunshot wound to her head. The weapon that killed her was a firearm chambered in 9mm Luger, which the police never found. About 600 feet away from the gravesite, there was a pair of boxer shorts, which Denise had been wearing. Sperm cells from Michael were found on these boxer shorts. On August 24, 2009, over a year and a half after the death of Denise Amber Lee, Michael Lee King went on trial for first-degree murder, sexual battery, and kidnapping. 4 days later, he was convicted of all three charges. On September 4, 2009, the jury recommended the death sentence by a vote of 12-0. Exactly 3 months later, Michael Lee King was sentenced to death, life in prison, and 30 years in prison. There was good news and bad news for Michael. The good news was that he only needed to serve one of those sentences. The bad news was that one sentence was death. On March 17, 2026, Michael ate his last meal comprising pizza, tater tots, soda, and ice cream. In the death chamber, his last words were, quote, "Since finding Jesus in prison, I have tried to live as his disciple, obeying the two great commandments, to love God with all my heart, my mind, and all my being, and to love my neighbor, to include everyone, my family, Denise Lee's family, everyone in the gallery, as well as Catholic volunteers who visit the prison, and those on the team to end my life," unquote. At 6:13 p.m., Michael Lee King was executed by lethal injection. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one. Michael Lee King maintained his innocence. However, his defense did not call a single witness during his trial. The only defense his attorneys offered was trying to create reasonable doubt by suggesting that one of Michael's friends could have killed Denise. The inculpatory factors were overwhelming in this case. For example, on the day of the kidnapping, the neighbor, Jennifer, saw a green Camaro in Denise's driveway. Michael's cousin, Harold, heard a woman in Michael's vehicle say, "Call the cops." A man named Sean heard a woman screaming for help from a Camaro when he was at a traffic light. Sean identified Michael as the driver. Jane Kowalski heard screams coming from a Camaro and saw a hand beating on the window. Denise Amber Lee used Michael's cell phone to call 911. Michael's voice was heard in the background of that call. Michael's DNA connected him to Denise's killing and sexual assault, and Denise's DNA was found in his vehicle. Item number two, after Michael was convicted, his defense attorneys argued that he did not deserve the death penalty. His background was revealed during the penalty phase. When Michael Lee King was 6 years old, he was involved in a sledding collision, which resulted in a serious head injury. His behavior changed significantly after this incident, and he had headaches. Michael attended special education classes, and his IQ score was 76. This is 1.6 standard deviations below the mean. Michael was at about the 5th percentile, meaning 95% of the population had an IQ score higher than him. At the age of 13, Michael almost killed his brother with a bow and arrow while imitating something he saw on a cartoon. When Michael was 17, he watched the movie The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Afterward, he obtained a chainsaw and chased his family members with it. They said he had no expression on his face. In December 2007, Michael broke up with his girlfriend and had serious financial problems due to unemployment. He started behaving strangely, as if he was in a catatonic state. People who knew him also reported he was paranoid. Another girlfriend said that on January 15, 2008, 2 days before the kidnapping, his behavior became more extreme. He believed his neighbors were looking in his windows. Despite the difficulty Michael had experienced throughout his life, his crime was so heinous, it did not save him from the death penalty. This brings me to item number three. What do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. In the time leading up to the murder, Michael became increasingly despondent and hopeless due to financial and relational stressors. He had mental health symptoms like paranoia, but he was fully aware of the difference between right and wrong. With life not going his way, Michael decided to indulge in his darkest fantasies. He reasoned that he had nothing to lose. He planned on going out in a blaze of glory, doing exactly what he always wanted to do. He started driving around in his Camaro looking for a victim. There is no evidence that Michael knew Denise, but he may have known that a young woman lived in her house. Maybe he saw her come home one day and made a mental note of it. It's also possible he just randomly stumbled upon her house. Michael knocked on her door. When Denise answered, he threatened her with a firearm. Michael kidnapped Denise, took her back to his house, and sexually assaulted her. At this point, he planned on killing her and disposing of her body, not wanting to murder her in his house, because that would leave too much evidence. He placed her in the back seat of his Camaro. Michael had not constructed a detailed plan. For instance, he did not have the items he needed to dispose of his victim. This is why he went to his cousin's house. He retrieved a shovel and other items. During the kidnapping, Denise did everything possible to save herself. She managed to get Michael's phone and used it to call 911. She communicated with Michael during the call in a way where the operator would understand what was happening. Denise was clever and resourceful, especially considering the tremendous amount of stress she was under. She gave the operator a lot of useful information. Michael realized his phone was missing, but not that Denise had called 911. Eventually, however, Michael caught on and took the phone away from her. Even at this point, Denise continued to fight for her life. She screamed and banged on the vehicle's window, which caught the attention of the motorist, Jane Kowalski. Jane immediately realized that she needed to act. She called 911 and gathered as much information as possible to identify the kidnapper and his vehicle. Michael realized that Jane was on to him, which is why he quickly turned left to get away from her. Jane did not get every detail right, but her actions were heroic. Unfortunately, the 911 operator violated procedure and squandered the opportunity Jane had created to save Denise. Michael escaped and had plenty of time to murder Denise and bury her body 3 feet in the ground. When the police finally caught up with Michael, the evidence that Denise created ensured his conviction. She was the reason he did not escape justice. It is possible that with Michael's nihilistic attitude, he would have continued committing homicides after killing Denise. This means that Denise's courageous actions may have saved other women from being murdered. She was unable to save herself, but Denise was able to preserve the lives of others. Her case also became part of a broader push to improve 911 training so that future calls would be handled with more urgency and precision. Denise fought intelligently, bravely, and relentlessly. The failure was not that she did too little, but that the system did not do enough. Those are my thoughts on the case of Denise Amber Lee. Thank you so much for watching. I'll talk to you soon. Just a reminder that I have hundreds of pre-release videos on my Patreon account. These videos are of the same quality as the videos I release to the public. When I put a video in pre-release status, it usually stays that way for several months, if not a year. I will put the link to Patreon in the description for this video.